Now, I'm extremely pleased to be able to participate in an AA meeting in any capacity that I'm allowed to participate in an AA meeting, regardless of wherever it is. And so I thank who's ever responsible for me being here. To give the privilege to be able to participate in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in any capacity is probably the greatest honor that can be bestowed upon a sober member of our fellowship. I'm tickled to death to be here fully clothed and in my right mind. Now, that may not make a lot of sense to you, and I really don't say it to make a lot of sense to you. It seems to me that the longer I remain sober in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the more necessary it becomes for me to remember from whence I came. See, I never want to forget that a little over 20 and a half years ago, I was crawling around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary. And because of a loving God as expressed himself through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. And if I got nothing else out of it at all, nothing, that knowledge and that knowledge alone sustains me most of my life. I would like to tell you tonight, if I may, because I don't know how to do anything else in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor says, if I don't tell you what I'm like and what happened to me, what I'm trying to be like today, I ain't giving an AA talk. And I don't want my sponsor mad at me. I just don't. So I like to tell you how I got to where I was 20 years ago. I worked at it. You don't just show up and say, here I am. You know, you got to get after it. And my problem was, all my life, is that I was looking for something. And the funny thing about that was I didn't know what I was looking for. Now, I don't really know whether I was born an alcoholic or not. I was born weird. I was. I just weird, and I kept getting worse. And right behind that feeling of being weird was a great wall of anger inside of me, and I think the anger was because I felt weird. And I had to have something to be angry at. And I didn't know what it was. I didn't feel like I belonged where I was. I didn't understand what was going on. I felt like I'd been dropped off from another planet by a spaceship or something, and I kept waiting for them to come and get me. I didn't know what was the matter with me. I looked around in life, and I wasn't like anybody I was around. I felt different from my brothers, and I looked around at them, and I kept trying to figure, why do I feel weird? Well, why am I different? Why don't I feel a part of? And I kept looking for an excuse to blame for why I felt the way I was. I had a built-in excuse. I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I said to myself, well, no wonder I feel different. I've been born beneath my station. I got to go out there and find out where I belong. Now, it's just common logic with me that these were the bad people, and I didn't belong around those people. I felt strange and different and weird and angry, and I hated them all. So if they were the bad people, I must belong where the good people are. Because there's only good ones and only bad ones. So I looked around for a good one. And there, smack dab in the middle of all that, was my grandmother. And my grandmother was a fantastic old lady. She was almost 90 years old, and she never took a drink of alcohol or smoked a cigarette in her life. My grandmother went to church a great deal. She prayed a great deal. But my grandmother, to me, was magnificent. And so wherever my grandmother went, I was going to go, because my grandmother was a good folk, and I didn't belong around the bad folk. So I gathered up with my grandmother one day to go where my grandmother went, where the good people were. And I left these bad people that I hated and felt different and strange around and apart from. I went with my grandmother, and we'd sit down in the church around all the good people. And I felt strange and different and apart from, and I hated all them too. And I didn't know what was going on. I didn't belong around the bad ones. I didn't belong around the good ones. I didn't know what was going on. Then a guy jumped up at the podium and said, I was supposed to love and honor and respect my parents. He said, you're supposed to love your brothers. And I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for reasons I didn't even understand. And God, I felt guilty about that. And I become frightened to death sitting in that church that people are going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. I didn't know what to do about that. I turned to walk outside the church. Now, I don't belong with the bad ones. I don't belong with the good ones. I'm really confused now. I get to the door of the church, and my old man's standing there drunk and hungover. He reached over and tapped me on the head and said, son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me. And if there was anything I didn't want to be, it was my old man. Because I hated him. My old man was a drunk. And I hated him for it. And my mother was a drunk. And I hated her for it. And I lived in a house where there's two drunks working. And only a little kid understands the terror of that if they've ever lived through it. In the middle of the night in a house like that, they're screaming and yelling and flesh hitting flesh and cussing and breaking furniture in deathly silence. And every once in a while, the old man come over there and drug me out and started kicking me around. Now, he never did it to my brothers. He just did it to me. And I lay there in my bed night after night after night, and I try to figure out what causes all those things. I said to myself, I wonder what causes my old man to be what he is. I wonder what causes my mother to be what she is. I wonder what puts my uncles in those penitentiaries. I wonder what makes my aunts work in those places that they work in. I wonder what makes my grandfather burn down barns. Wonder why all those things are possible. Very logical with me. It was alcohol. And I said to myself, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to be like those people. I'm going to be better than they are. I'm going to step out in that world and find out where maybe I don't belong with the good ones, and maybe I don't belong with the bad ones, but I'm going to find that place someday. But what do you do if you're weird? What if you don't belong anywhere in the world? What do you do if you're sitting over there glued up against the corner of the wall and you're trying to figure what's the matter with me? You're always out there looking for something. Out of curiosity, one day I took a drink of alcohol. Just out of curiosity. With no major decision on my part. It was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. It went down in there and just ripped that madness out of me. That's what alcohol did for me. It took me from the black pit of nothingness. It stood me onto the gray fringes of the business of living and installed me a sense of air and says, damn you world, it's all right. Maybe I'm not good enough to be with the good people. Maybe I'm too good to be around the bad people, but it's okay right here. That's what alcohol did for me. Now, I'm going to tell you the strange secret that I know. If alcohol still did that, I'd still drink it. That's as simple as I know how to put it. I know when alcoholics quit drinking, they quit drinking when it don't work anymore. They just have to have an answer. I've always had to have an answer. Then I pray to God that the alcoholics of the world don't run into what I ran into when alcohol quit working. I hope they don't run into an understanding doctor who substitutes their liquid for tablets. That happened to me. Now, I'd like to tell you, during the next 20 years of my life, I discovered some wonderful way to drink alcohol. I never did. I'm a hog. Hogs don't drink well. I'm one of them types of people, if one would do it, what would 32 do for you? That's the way I am. I don't know why that is, and my sponsor's not like that. He's weird. Well, he is. He come running into the meeting one day where I was at. He said, God, I got a headache. Go get me an aspirin. And I ran around and got him two Excedrins. God, I was proud. He held out his hand and put two Excedrins in there. He said, I only want one. I said, take two. You won't have a headache tomorrow. Now, he didn't understand that at all. So I thought it was hilarious. I'm rolling around on the floor, really very pleased with myself because I was cute. But that's the way I am. I don't know anything else. I triggered a pattern for drinking that I followed for 20 years of my life and never varied. I took a drink of alcohol, and 3 days later, I was pulled out from underneath a bridge, stood in front of a judge, and sent into the Hutchinson State Reform School. I was taken out of the reform school and put in a foster home. And in that foster home, there was a lady that wore a crispy apron, and she lived in a little white house. There was a knock on that door one day, and I was taken out of that foster home by my mother and brought to California. We left Kansas on our way to California. My mother said, kid, we get to California, things are going to be different. And I don't know what my brothers thought. I know what I thought. I thought, man, we get to California, we're going to get us a white house. We'll get us a little picket fence, and my mother's going to get her a crispy apron and a tray full of cookies and milk. I'm going to bring my friends in the house. I'm going to say, this is my mother. I'm not going to have to smile at people I don't want to smile at anymore. I'm not going to have to be around people I don't want to be around anymore. I'm not going to have to act around people some way I don't want to act anymore. I'm just going to be able to be when we get over there. I was suffered with that alcoholic delusion that if I could put it together over there, this would be fine. We left a one-room shack in Kansas and went to California and got us a one-room shack with a bathroom. My mother got me a couple of new uncles and introduced them to me. And I went on the street corner and got drunk. And I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing for me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, it was the only thing I'd ever found that ever did the same thing twice in succession. See, I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations that high off the ground and have somebody come along and kick the stool out from underneath me. But I found out if I threw a brick through a window and got a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, it did exactly what I anticipated doing. It went down inside of me and tore that madness out of me. It took me from there and stood me there and installed in me that sense of arrogance that, damn you, world, it's okay. It's okay. And I got drunk and went to juvenile hall. I was in juvenile hall a little while, and my mother came to visit me. She said a very strange thing to me. She said, I love you and I miss you. When you come home, things are going to be different. And I wasn't buying it. Not me. I'm not going to get my belly kicked out anymore. A couple of weeks later, I went in front of a judge, and he sent me to Whittier State Reform School. My mother stood with a lawyer and appealed it. I thought about that. And a couple of weeks later, my mother came to visit me. She said, I love you and I miss you. When you come home, things are going to be different. For 3.5 years, we went through that court battle with my mother and her lawyer and the judge and I. The judge was sentenced, and an old mom was appealing. And the only thing that happened somewhere during that 3.5 years is I tore down my defenses and started to believe my mother. Because I wanted to believe her. I wanted to believe if I could just put it together over there, I'd be all right. I wouldn't have that madness all about me. I wouldn't have that different feeling about me. And so I lived with that dream and aspiration, became an obsession. Now, I don't know what you're an authority on. I'm an authority on obsessions. I've lived with them all my life. And I live with them a great deal of the time today. And I don't know how they start off in your life, but me, they start off like little thoughts, you know, like a streak in the dark. God, that was good going through there. I wonder what it was. And here it comes back again. The first thing you know, it's all you can see. Now, our founders and our co-founders could have gave our illness any name they wanted to give it. But they gave us a name that is medically, clinically, and psychiatrically untreatable. They gave us a name called obsessions of the mind. There isn't any way medically, clinically, or psychiatrically to treat an obsession of the mind. God has to remove them. In the so-called intellectual world of life, there's no room for God. If you can't figure it out, it don't work. Now, I didn't know that. I became obsessed with an idea. When I got home, things were going to be fine. One day I went in front of that judge and he put me in a boys' home in San Fernando Valley. When I got there, the superintendent said, if you're a good kid, we're going to let you go home on a home trip in 30 days. And God, that was good. 30 days came and went and he put us on an old truck and he brought us out of the valley. I can remember like it was yesterday. It was an all-day trip. It drops off in downtown Hollywood. I had to run to catch the old subway car to ride downtown Los Angeles. Got on a streetcar and rode out to Willowbrook where I live. And I got off the ground running 1.5 miles to my mother's house. And around the corner down the street, there it's going to be again. No more madness, no more different than, no more apart from, it's going to be okay. And I got to my mother's house, there was a drunken party going on there. Nothing changed, except me. I spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall. I heard a lot of strange things. I heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a cheat. Never believe anybody that used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. Never show anybody that you care for them that used to tell me because that's weakness. And more important than anything else, never reach your hand up out of the gutter because the minute you do that, somebody comes along and kicks you in the teeth. Now, I didn't want to believe that because there was something down inside of me that said, no, 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 it's not true. But I walked out of my mother's house that day and made a vow to myself. I lived to be 500 years old. I'd never show anybody any human emotions again. And I went on the street corner and got drunk. Went back to school and come home next month and got drunk again. Along about that time in my life, I was a periodic. Well, I was forced to be a periodic. They only let me out once a month, so I only got drunk once a month. And it was always the same thing. I'd come home, throw a brick through a window, get a bottle of Marco Petri red wine, and get drunk and go back to school. Now, my first week in school was all right because I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercise. My second week in school was all right because I was a scholar. I read inspirational books. My third week is when the madness set in because I started to think. I started thinking about showing up in a neighborhood. I started thinking about walking up to the gang. The gang wanted me to be their leader. I don't want to be their leader. I keep saying to myself, what if the gang was to say tonight if I had to tell them I don't want to be a gangster? I want to be a doctor or a lawyer or an architect or an engineer. What if they would say? What if they would say if I had to tell them I didn't want to go out and hit people in the head, I wanted to go play baseball? What would they would say? Just if you're like me, then you're nothing. And you're glued up over there against that wall and you're trying to figure out what is that magic thing that frees from there and stands you there and gives you that. What is that thing that frees you out in the world, lets you become free to do whatever you want to do and be what you want to be and have what you want to have and become what you want to become? The answer is come. It's a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. One day I sit down in a street corner and drink my wine at a gallon of it. Madness was all about me. I drank the whole gallon. I'm sober as I am right now. Frightened to death because my magic wasn't magic anymore. I didn't know what to do about it. And a guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try these? And he gave me some pills. I found if I ate pills and drank wine, I could make the madness go away for a little while. It wasn't very much longer sitting on the same street corner with a sack of pills and a gallon of wine. Nothing was working. And a guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try this? And he gave me some morphine. Found I put morphine in my arms and swallowed pills and drank wine, that I had a combination of things to sustain me for the next 14 years of my life. It was never one, or it was never two, it was a combination of everything. I became too old to stay in that school. I came out of my neighborhood to become a gangster. That was my ambition in life. I wanted to be the Irish Lucky Luciano of Willowbrook. But I had a problem I didn't stand up too often. And that's not conducive for being a gangster. You got to look alert when you're out there doing them things. You know, you can't run and say, stick them up and puke on people. They kind of puke you out the doorway or something. It blows that macho image down the tubes or something. You know, you got to look cool when you're out there doing them things. My God, you know. Hell, if I'd have been any cooler when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have froze to death. You know, but you got to play that game out there. You know, you can't. You know, I found out what that great unnamed fear of the alcoholic is. It's the fear of discovery. You don't ever want anybody to know what's going on in here. I spent my entire lifetime trying to keep this masqueraded from the world, and doing that I had to play everything for everybody. Wherever I was, that's where I had to be. And by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was an absolute nothing. Because all the roles I played were so heavy I couldn't pack them any longer. I got arrested again, and again, and again. They even got arrested and sentenced to the Army once. I can tell you about my Army career very briefly. I'm not eligible for the GI Bill of Rights. Whatever that means. You ever have spiritual awakenings in your practicing days? I used to have great visions. I remember one time I was in a guardhouse in Fort Lewis, Washington, in a thunderstorm. And I had a big flash of light, and it dawned on me that lack of power was my dilemma. I thought power came in a money clip. And so I came out of the Army to accumulate some power, and I got it all. I got everything that life says is successful out there. I got a big apartment building I moved in, and I got a closet full of $300 suits. I got a big automobile down in my garage, and I got people coming at my beck and call, and the big man was there. The only problem was the big man couldn't leave the apartment building because the police jumped on him all the time. Every once in a while, I used to get brave. I'd put on one of my big suits, and I'd sneak down the back stairs. I'd get my big automobile, and I'd drive up and down the streets. 5 o'clock, people would come home from work. And I'd drive up alongside of people in old beat-up pickup truck, and I'd say to myself, I wonder what's wrong with me. Why I'm not like him? Why can't I be like my older brother? Why can't I just go to work and have a couple kids and come home and have a house like my older brother? I wonder what there is about me that's different. You see, I didn't know that this time that I know today. But I'm hanging on to the last thread of sanity that an insane person hangs on to. I had run out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions to blame for my dilemma, but I still had a kicker. It's God's fault. He don't like me. It's my grandmother's God who punished little boys who were bad. God's been kicking me around ever since I can remember. You hear every once in a while, maybe, well, I guess if God wants me to have this, he's going to give it to me. Next time you get hungry, pray for a hot dog. And if he sends you one down the chute, call me. I've been looking for that deal all my life. But that's the way it was. 1951, I'm on my way to the penitentiary. I'm staying in a Los Angeles County jail, and my mother's standing on the other side of the visiting screen. She's screaming at me that I'm a murderer. It seemed that my 17-year-old brother had gotten into some of my poison and taken an overdose of it and died. I didn't know how to handle that very well. I handled it like I handled everything else, with complete anger. That's the way I handle things, with absolute anger. I get angry at it. And I've come to understand, since I've been hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous, that anger is no more than a wrong man's righteousness. That's all it is. If I'm angry, I'm wrong. And the only thing that's happened to me since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous is I'm not as angry as I used to be. And the longer I stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, the less anger there is within me. God removed that too, I guess, through his mercy. I remember handcuffed between three detectives 3 days later, standing underneath the tree while they buried my baby brother. I got all the guilt and shame and humiliation of a lifetime hanging on my shoulders. And I'm trying to cry, I don't know how. I keep saying, why? Let him go. Let me lay down there. Let him go. He got a life. He's a good kid. He's just not that merciful. I spent the next 4.5 years of my life locked up in the penitentiary. I came out there trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me wasn't true. He said, Johnny, people like you don't change. He says, you're doomed to die in an institution. He took me down and showed me the little green room one day. He said, you're going to end up here. I gave you my stock answer and trade. Not me. I'm different. I come walking out of the institution bound determined I had that deal beat, and 6 months later I'm laying in the nut house, kicking and screaming. And that's when I started making my rounds to some of the better laughing academies in the world, interviewing psychiatrists. Well, that's what I do when I have nothing better to do. I sit with my wraparound overcoat on, and they have their glasses down on their nose, and we engage in meaningful conversation. They talk about my mother, I talk about their mother, and they throw me out of the room. You know, and then they took me out and wired me for sound. That'll get your attention in a hurry, boy. Yes, doctor. And then we sit down. And the story has been repeated to the alcoholic since time immemorial. Me, an inferior being, looking to a superior being for an answer to my dilemma, and there is no answer. Looking to the superior beings of life one more time for the key that will unlock the gates of hell, and all I get is confusion and mumbo jumbo and nonsense that makes no sense to me. No ring of truth about it. You know what the doctors used to tell me? Johnny, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problems. Those were never my problems. My problem was I was scared all the time. And I was frightened to death somebody was going to find out I was scared. I didn't belong anywhere in this world. I had been everywhere. I hated everything that I saw. I thought I was absolutely and totally insane. And the only thing that gave me a moment's peace was the thing that I put inside of me. Now, anything that gives you peace is not a problem. It's an answer to a problem. So when the superior being told an inferior being one more time, and to add to his confusion, that the answer to his life was the problem of his life, that person, it's like me, walked off the end of that home one more time and said, nobody knows. And so I spent the next 9 months of my life trying to kill me. And 20 years ago, last January, or February, somewhere around there, I don't know. I didn't know it was going to be important for me to remember it. They laid me down in the bed in the Los Angeles County Jail. I weighed 128 pounds, and I was yellow, and I had my left arm and my right leg tied down, and another superior being stood at the foot of my bed and said to the inferior being, son, you're going to die, and there's nothing I can do for you. What a relief it was. He turned to walk out of the room. All day passed and all night passed. He'd come back in my room the next morning. He stood there and he said, son, you're going to die and there's nothing I can do for you. And I said, okay, doctor. The third day he got ready to come back in my room, had a terror grip me that I've never known before since in my entire lifetime. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to get up out of that bed and go to the penitentiary and come back out and start that rat race all over again, and God knows I didn't want to do that. I laid there for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I ever said in my life. I said, oh, God, help me. Now, I thought for a long, long time that nothing happened, because there was no blinding flash of light, nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying, we got an A meeting down there. Little bird didn't drop the fifth chapter on my chest, and none of those things have ever happened to me. What's really happened to me since, in the 20 years that's come and gone since then, is that I've had a number of people coming into my life telling me the truth. I remember standing in front of a judge. The judge had sentenced me to 20 years in a maximum security penitentiary. I turned to walk out of the courtroom. That don't mean anything to me. That's the game I played. You win some, you lose some. Just many things that matter if you get your turn at bat. As I got to the door of the courtroom, he changed the conversation from me to a lady who was sitting in the courtroom. And what he said to her was the most damning piece of evidence anybody had ever presented on me in life. He said to her, "Lady, if you care anything at all about the child you carry inside of you, you get so far away from this scum, you'll never be allowed to lay eyes on it. He's a blood-sucking parasite in society, and he has no right being around decent people. As in my power, he ain't never going to be." And I'm walking out of the courtroom saying to myself, "He's not talking about me. He's talking about my old man, or my uncles, or my grandfather, or somebody. But he was talking about me. And I knew he was talking about me. He laid the truth all over me, and I couldn't run and hide from it anymore. And the evidence was so damning that finally my secret had been exposed for the world to see that I ran and hid in solitary confinement for the next 9 months of my life. And that's the way I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 18 and a half years ago. I take no credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, none whatsoever. I take no credit for being absolute and totally clean from any type of a chemical in my system for 18 and a half years. None whatsoever, because if I'd have known that, if I'd have known where I was coming 18 and a half years ago, I wouldn't have come. That simple. You know why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous? Because the institution I was in allowed women to come in there. I came in here 18 and a half years ago to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around her ever since. You gotta watch. Nancy don't smell too bad. You gotta watch what gets them. I remember my first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous. I sit in the back row in what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. I had my coat collar up and my shades on, because that's cool. I looked up on the backboard and I saw two big A's, and I thought to myself, "My God, I've wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade." I said to this clown sitting next to me, "What is this?" And he says, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be around those winos. If it had been Gangsters Anonymous or old wore-out Hipsters Anonymous or something, I'd have been up there waiting. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Of course, I didn't know what an alcoholic was, but I didn't want to be one. I was suffering from a principle that's written in our book. It's in the spiritual experience. It says, "There is a principle which is a boon to mankind, which is bound to keep in me an everlasting ignorance. And that is the principle of contempt prior to investigation." And I lived all my life with contempt prior to investigation. See, what I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was a never was. A never was is something that's so frightened of failing he doesn't try to do anything. He just sits around wherever he's at and says, "Tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to get up off this floor, out of this nut house, tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to be the one thing in the world they're proud of, tomorrow. Tomorrow I was sick. Tomorrow I had to get well. The only thing that broke up when I got arrested, and that's why I was when I came to AA." But I sit in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw the miracle. What I saw was his people. I didn't understand them. These people with the twinkling eyes and the smiling faces and this air of radiance and peace about them, I did not understand that. Right away they ruined it. They talked about God. I got them ran out of the room. When I came here and you talked to me about God, I left. And the reason I left was because you talked about God. And when you talked to me about God, I thought about a God my grandmother told me about, who was the reason I was. You see, God can always be the reason you are if you don't want to shut the blame for your own responsibilities. God will be the reason it is. The great whipping post, old Father. I kept coming back to their meetings on Sunday. Just coming back there. Because I wanted to see those strange people with the dancing eyes and the smiling faces. I got up one Sunday morning. Now, I don't know what Sunday morning it was just Sunday morning. I didn't have the slightest idea that was the day I did my whole life for. I had no way of knowing that when I woke up that morning. I had no way of knowing that morning that I was going to sit in a room and somebody was going to insert the key into the gates of hell or let me out. I had no way of knowing that, because if I'd have known it, I wouldn't have went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I don't know where. I probably went over and talked to one of the lettered people who know all those things. I probably went to another one of those superior, quote, superior people, to talk to an inferior person. But not armed with that knowledge, I went to an AA meeting. And I sit in my usual seat, my throne of contempt. And a little man that I knew did 23 fat years in the penitentiary stood at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous on a Sunday morning a long, long time ago and told me something I have never forgotten. It made more sense to me than anything I'd ever heard. It makes more sense to me tonight than anything that I know. He said to me, "You just don't have to live this way no more if you don't want to." He says, "You don't have to do it like this no more." Nobody ever told me that. People have been telling me all my life not to drink, swallow, smoke, and shoot. But nobody ever told me how to live without doing it. After meeting, I ran up to this guy and I said, "Gee, how do you learn how to live?" He looked at me and he smiled and he said, "Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. If you go get it, I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in it." Now, I guess that little guy's prayed real hard, because I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. And the only thing I found in that book is me. I'm not looking for anything else. I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world. And I'm not looking for a way to cure all society's ills either. What I'm looking for is a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me, period. Now, I'm going to tell you about the strange phenomena that takes place in my life. It seems like to me that the closer I adhere to the principles that are written in this book, and the more willing I become to share this knowledge in this fellowship just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. Now, I'd like to tell you that I'm one of them folks who wandered into the door, put the plug in the jug and my seat in the seat, and the sweet bird of happiness has been following me ever since. Amen. You know anybody like that? There's one of two things wrong with them. They're either nuttier than hell or they're taking something. They don't live where I live, in the world. You see, I'm still not of the world. Not yet. I fought Alcoholics Anonymous tooth and nail when I came here. I fought it with everything in me. Now, I know as I stand before tonight that it wasn't me fighting you so much as what was within me was fighting what was within you. See, I had never seen goodness in abundance. All I ever saw was that filth that was my life. And so when I saw goodness in abundance, it frightened me to death. And when I became frightened, I started to attack it. So I tried to attack Alcoholics Anonymous, but I couldn't fight you. You wouldn't fight. I remember one time, one guy used to come to that institution, I didn't like him at all. He was a blowhard. He'd come in there one time, he's talking about the book. He said, "This is in the book." Well, you got to be careful. You got one of them skeptics like me sitting in the audience, you talking about the book, it better be in there. I spent a solid month researching this book and couldn't find that statement. And so I got ready for it. I stood at the gate. And you know how you got it all planned. I'm going to say this, he's going to say that. And then he's going to say this, and then I'm going to hit him. Right in front of his friends. You're in a frenzy by the time Sunday comes. You're standing there. You know, you got the book under your arm. You're just ready. And the guy walked up to you and said, "You're a liar." He said, "Oh?" I said, "You said this is in the book. I read it all month, and you're a liar. It's not in there." He said, "So what?" He walked by me. You know, it's humanly impossible to attack anything that won't fight you. Yeah, I want you to know that it wasn't very much longer after that that I was imitating people. I was saying, "Welcome to AA. It's a wonderful way to live. Come join a happy program. I take a minute, sit them in the chair for the coffee and smile. That's wonderful, wonderful. I go back in the corner and die." But I did everything they told me to do. You know, I was active. I was picking up chairs and ashtrays and pouring coffee, and I was still dying inside. I was still apart from alcohol. In the corner. I was not part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was apart from it. They'd sit there and say, "I wonder why I'm not there. I wonder what different these people are. Maybe I've gone too far down the road. Maybe I don't belong to this program. I'm doing what they told me to do, and I don't feel like they look. I read this book and nothing happened." One day I looked down and saw the most simple statement I'd ever seen in my life in that book. It said, "How it works." Which I almost missed that. I think I was looking for the good fairy. You know him, don't you? He's the one who blesses all them wonderful folks. And speakers just say, I came in here, everything is wonderful. I go sit in his chair. I knew that's where he was coming next. It doesn't happen that way. I found it necessary to do the things just to do in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I found it necessary for me to fulfill the conditions of recovery in this program. I found it necessary to sit down with a tablet and a pencil and write about the things that were killing me. I found myself one day, 3.5 hours, sitting and talking to a man, telling him about every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life. And I walked out of the man's room, and somewhere during that transition period of 3.5 hours, that great big ball of madness had left me and never had been returned. Sometime during that 3.5 hour period of my life, I made a transition from apart from to a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason that happened to me was because I had become willing to fulfill the conditions of this program. See, I cannot be a part of something if I won't fulfill its conditions. I can be apart from, and I was. I ran around like a chicken with my head cut off, doing all the things that would get me ego's applause and all them wonderful things for my sick ego. But the things that were necessary for my fulfillment in life, the thing that would remove me from the back row and apart from Alcoholics Anonymous to a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to do. And they're outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And strange things started to happen to me after that. People kept coming into my life that had no right being in my life, teaching me things they had no right teaching me. Now, at this particular time, I was a barber in this institution, and my vocabulary consisted of about four-letter words. Mother ran all the way around in there somewhere. It's just part of my vocabulary. I didn't talk any other way. That's the way I was supposed to talk. And I'm sitting there cussing this little dentist one day. He's talking to me, and I'm cussing him back. You know, that's the way I talk to him. He said, Johnny, if you ever get out of here, what are you going to do? And I told him, in my vocabulary, he said, it'll never work. I said, why not? He said, the minute you open your mouth, they're going to know where you come from. I said, what's the matter with my mouth? He says, nothing, you just open it every now and then. Now, this guy had to be the smartest or the dumbest man I've ever met in my life, but I had a straight razor in my hand. But see, this was after I had become willing to fulfill the conditions of this program, which brought about me some type of teachableness, I hope, because I heard myself saying a very strange thing. I says, what am I supposed to do about it? He says, are you serious? And I said, you bet I am. He says, you know what cussing is, Johnny? And I said, no, what is it? He says, a crutch for conversational cripples. And I said to myself, well, I've always talked this way. He said, are you serious? You want to change? I said, yeah. He said, come over and sit with me and my friends. He got 3 of his friends from town, businessmen from the town. And every Tuesday night for a period of time, these people, word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, fed me the English language. One day the dentist sat in my chair and he said, tonight you get to give the talk, John. Not me. What am I going to talk about? He said, what about that program you love so much you're always telling me about? He said, what do they do? I said, oh, that's simple. They just tell you what it was like and what happened, what it was trying to be like. They said, try that. Then I went over and told my 4 little friends what I was like, what happened to me, what I was trying to be like that day. You know what they did? They gave me a little statue about that high. Oh, I love that statue. It's the only thing in my life I'd ever gotten I hadn't stolen. And I carried it with me wherever I went. It was my badge of excellence. I kept it with me. I showed everybody how I was doing in my statue. See how wonderful I am. There's my statue. That's what I was telling me. Wonderful. My badge of excellence. You know what I did next Tuesday? I went over there and the guy who owned the restaurant in town got up and gave a talk and they gave him my statue. God, I hated him. I sat in that meeting all night long watching that old man trying to figure out how I was going to leap on a tree and get my statue back from him. I laid awake for a solid week in absolute madness trying to figure out how I was going to get out of that institution, run 15 miles, break into his restaurant, steal my statue, and get back before they knew I was gone. You know what I learned from that little story in my life? I've learned that anything that you can hold in the palm of your hand, a touch, has no value in God's eyes. that the real storehouse in my father's treasure chest are the things that are promised in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, called peace, happiness, joy, and tranquility. Those are the storehouses of my father's treasure chest. Now I'm his kid, and those are my inheritance gifts from my father to his child. But I've come to understand, since I've been hanging around people like you, before I can receive the gifts of the inheritance from my father, I have to become worthy enough to receive them. I have to act like his child. I got kids at home. It's my great pleasure to bestow great things on my children. I'd love to give my kids. The only thing they got to do is act like they're mine. And they get anything they want. It's amazing. Now, it would be ridiculous for me to even think that my father wants any less for me. It'd be ridiculous for me to think so. I came out of that penitentiary 17 years ago last month. I walked out of that penitentiary. My mother fell off the steps blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on the couch and said, "Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting." She said, "Fine, I think you should." It took my mother a long time to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very proud to tell you that when my mother's sober, she goes to meetings. Well, that's something. She never used to come to meetings. She used to stay drunk all the time. See, I have knowledge about things. I know if my mother lives long enough or doesn't go permanently insane and she keeps coming to these meetings, she's going to get sober and stay sober. I know that. I know as well as I'm standing here. I've learned the greatest lesson in life from my mother. The greatest lesson that I've ever learned in life, I learned from my mother. I learned I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. I don't even have any power to keep me sober. I do what's ever asked for me to do in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and from my God comes the power. As of myself, I don't even have enough power to stand here. I have no power of my own, not even to breathe in and out. The power must come from a God. Where am I going to find that God? Where do you find God? You're on a mountaintop? Where would he be? God. Where would a lost soul like me find a God? A guy wrote about it in the 14th century. A little guy, a little Carmelite monk, he said, if you were to find God, you'd have to look deep within yourselves. Isn't that amazing? That's the fourth step. But another guy wrote about it. He said that nature abhors a vacuum, but God abhors a vacuum even more under heaven and earth. And if you were to empty yourself of self, you would be automatically full of God. Isn't that amazing? Now, I don't know what happens to you. I do know that when I am given the extreme privilege of carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to a sick alcoholic or a sick person, it seemed like to me that if I would tell them what I'm like and what happened to me, what I'm trying to be like today, that I leave with an abundance that I didn't go there with. Now, that would only carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to a sick alcoholic or a sick person. It seemed like to me that if I would tell them what I'm like and what happened to me, what I'm trying to be like today, that I leave with an abundance that I didn't go there with. Now that would only simulate to me that I have removed me from the picture and become full of my father. My only object in life is to try to keep that feeling all the time, but I can't because I'm engaged in the business of living every day of my life. I've got to get out there and hack it in a world who does not live by those principles. And so what I do all day long is I survive in a world that I don't understand in, that I must function in as a part of my fulfillment in life, until I can come in here and work and be around the people that give me life and I give life to them.
That's what A is to me. Now, I did all the things in AA do. I became successful. Oh, did I get successful? Quote, unquote. I got all the things that are supposed to be necessary. I got the big house in Lakewood. I got a big closet full. I got a wife. My wife came back and got that little girl and gave birth to another little baby. I went to work, worked 14, 16 hours a day and went to meetings. At the end of 6 years, I'm parking my car by the door of the meeting, and people say, how you doing? I say, see my car? They say, how you doing? I say, look at my new suit. I say, how you doing? I say, I never had it so good. Easy does it. First things first. Live and let live, but for the grace of God. Wonderful, wonderful. You know, we even closed Disneyland at 10 o'clock. And I had to go out into the real world. The world that I couldn't talk about, because I had an image of sobriety that was killing me. And I drive down to Lakewood and walk into an empty house. And I start walking up and down the street to find my two infant children. And I'd find my two infant kids at the babysitter, and I'd put them in the car, and we started making around to the bars to find their mother. And we'd pull around the bar, ceremoniously or unceremoniously, however it may be, and the conversation always went the same thing. I'd say to her, why, Nancy? Why do you do this? Why do you drink? Why don't you say, you're a drag? And I'd be shocked, because I was doing the very best thing I knew how to do. She'd say, yeah, you know, fun. All you want to do is go to those meetings and work and stay home with your kids. I want to go out and dance and listen to the music and have fun. And you could come along with me and drink Cokes. I don't like Cokes. But I thought about going. I thought about going. One night I almost went, and I broke out into sweat, cold sweat, because I almost went. But I didn't. And the next morning I went and told this woman that I was married to that I couldn't live the way we were living. She didn't want to live my life. I didn't want to live her life. So it looked like we were going to have to leave, and it looked like it was going to be me. An hour later she took her own life. I didn't know how to handle that very well either. I handled it like I handled everything else, with absolute anger. I got mad at everything. I live in a big house in Lakewood. Everything in life is important and successful in life, quote and unquote. 2 months later, I'm living in a $60 a month rented room in East Long Beach, and I'm still working and I'm buried in debt. And I'm going sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in absolute rage and anger. People would jump up to the podium and say, I came here 90 days ago and got wonderful. And I'm sitting back there and say, I wonder when I'm going to get mine. Look what I'm doing. I'm doing all these wonderful things. And look what's happening to me. You know how sick that is? I'm sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous expecting to be rewarded for receiving a gift. That's how sick I was. The gift is sobriety. One night I went to a meeting, my sponsor was talking. And I went there. You know what he talked about? About his home and his wife and his kids and his job. You know what I thought about? I thought about leaving AA. Another one of them phony stories. After the meeting, I went up to shake his hand because that's what I was conditioned to do. I couldn't get near him because there was a crowd of people around him, so I... too much effort for me, so I started to turn to walk away. And my sponsor must have saw me out of the corner of his eye because he come and got me. And he put his arms around me. Now, he don't hug very easy, my sponsor, but he hugged me. And he said strange things to me. He said, gee, Johnny, God must love you a great deal. I looked at him and I said, I don't think so. He says, yeah, he never gives any more we can handle, and those who got the biggest load got to be the blessed. And I promptly told him I didn't want to be blessed anymore either. And then he hit me with something I didn't quite understand, and I probably still don't understand it fully. He said, remember this. He gives big crosses to big horses, and he gives little crosses to guys named John. And I went home that night and tried to figure out how big my cross was. And I didn't have one, because I was sober, and I had been sober. And although there had been a few dark clouds running in my life, there were countless days of sunshine. There were countless days of my life that I'd wandered around out there in that world as a blade of grass in a long life. Like a little child frolicking in the pasture. So one or two clouds come into my life, and what does the big man do? My egotism wants to throw the whole thing down. I got down somewhere I hadn't been there for a long time. I got on my knees that night, and I said a little prayer that I say every day in my life. God, relieve me from the bondage of self, that I may be a witness to those who see of your undying mercy and love. Amen. And I got up off my knees that night, and it seemed like to me that I turned and walked toward the sunshine, because I've been walking toward the mirror since. Shortly thereafter, I'm walking through a park on a 4th of July picnic, and a little blue-eyed angel, 5'2", offered me a piece of chicken. I want you to know I've been paying for that chicken ever since. No, I'm very seriously. God has brought a dimension to my life that never been there before. And it also solidifies my belief that God, in His infinite wisdom, brings to me what I need when I need it. And He brought Dottie to me in an hour of need, and I needed her. And it was no big romantic thing. I just wanted somebody to go to meetings with, and so she went to meetings with me. And one night I said to her, we were coming home for a meeting, or we were at an AA party, and I said, hey, how about getting married? And she said, yeah. Damn near scared me to death. And I got frightened. And so I ran down to my father in AA, who lives on a mountain in Laguna. And I'm scared to death. And I said, oh, I've made a terrible mistake, Papa. He said, what's the matter? And I said, I asked somebody to marry me that I love very much. And she said, yes. And he went laughing. And I said, I don't think it's funny. I'm scared. I said, you don't seem to understand. I destroy everything I touch. Everything that's ever been good in my life, I've destroyed, and it frightens me. And he laughed at silly little giggly as again. And I said, tell me something. And he said, what's that? I said, you and Mama got a good life. I watched you. Your marriage is good. What do you do? He looked at me and he said, son, when I got sober, he said, I went home and asked Miss C if she would allow me the privilege to love her. I'd never ask her to do another living thing as long as I live. I carried that idea into my marriage. And you know, when I practice that principle in my life gets great. It's just fantastic. When I ask my wife to allow me the privilege to love her and make no demands upon her, my life is an absolute thing of beauty. Now I'll tell you, that's what AA is. Now I didn't know that. That's what AA is. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous love with no reservations, no expectations of receiving anything in return. Nothing. They talk about it in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. We love for free and for fun. Now I had to practice it with a human being that I live with. And I practiced it very well in meetings. I remember when I was new, I used to run around with an old lady by the name of Myrtle Snyder. And I used to, didn't see her every once in two or three weeks. And I was like a little kid. I used to run into her and tell her mom, I said, this is what I did last week. I went to this meeting, I went to that meeting, I went to this institution, I did this institution. She said, wait a minute. She said, you don't have to do anything for me to love you. She said, I just love you. Can't you buy that? And I said, oh, yes. She said, wait a minute. She said, you don't even have to stay sober for me to love you. I said, oh, yes, I understand. And I ran around there, and said, for free and for fun, I do this, I do that, just for the love of doing it. Wonderful, wonderful. Then somebody that I sponsored got up to take a cake. They better mention my name. That's not for free and for fun, folks. That's for egotism and recognition. Not very long ago, somebody that I love very much, like my own son, 8 years sober, he's 26 years old, come by my house to pick me up to take me to a meeting. It was on a Sunday morning, and we're going over to Torrance, and we're driving along in the car, and I said, how you doing, son? He said, not too good, Papa. And I said, why not? He said, I got loaded Thursday. I said, oh. He said, you don't understand, I got loaded Friday, too. I said, oh. I got loaded Saturday, too. And I said, oh. He said, as a matter of fact, I'm half loaded right now. I said, that's all right, son. I love you. You didn't have to do nothing to earn that. I just love you. You didn't have to stay sober. But I knew what I was saying. You know, it took me 18 years to be able to say it without expecting him to say, I love you too, back. And I will live up to your conditions of life, back. I can say it tonight before you, I love you. You don't have to be anything for that. You don't have to do nothing, you have to stay sober. All you got to do is let me do the only thing I've ever wanted to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Come and sit in your meetings and be part of you and part of your life. That's all I want to do. That's all I want to be. I have any other expectations or ambitions to become anything else. The greatest, proudest thing in my life is that I'm a regular participating member of my own home group. They allow me to mop the floor down there. They won't care where I was Saturday night. All they'll be caring about is if I'm mopping them floors. They don't seem to understand. I started that group. They say, shut up and mop, sponsor. See, I'm a firm believer in that. I'm a firm believer. If you're not affiliated with a home group and you don't have a sponsor, then you're not fulfilling conditions. I'm a firm believer in that. Yeah, I got to have a home group. I got to be affiliated with somewhere where I am, where the drunks can find me. And I have to be able to turn my judgment over to somebody, because my own best judgment got me in that cell of solitary confinement. My own best judgment. My own best judgment today will destroy me. Self will run riot. That's me. That's me. So I got a sponsor. You know what he tells me? Don't be bringing a poor mouth to me, he said. You ain't sick and you ain't locked up. You ain't got nothing to complain about. Oh. That's as simple as it gets. Don't get much more complicated than that. My life is in abundance. You know that girl I was never supposed to see, the little baby, the judge, the superior being said to the inferior being 20 years ago? You know what that little girl never saw? I was sitting in an auditorium a couple years ago where she walked down the aisle and got a diploma. I'd raised her, and I broke down and started to cry. And sitting on one side of me was her sister, and on the other side was a lady from Alcoholics Anonymous. And they put her arms around me and said, go ahead and cry, sweetheart, you got to write. If you were to poll the audience, they'd tell you you can't get from where you were to where you are. And they wouldn't, they'd tell you that. Go out and walk around the facets of society, and they'd tell you, you got to earn the good life. You got to do this, you got to work, study and become to earn the good life. That's not true. I could never in my life do enough good things in this life to repay what was given to me just this one day. No way. January, this girl I was never supposed to see called me on the phone, got me out of bed. She said, Daddy, and I said, yep. She said, I want you to talk to your new son-in-law. No, I wouldn't pick out that jerk. I had it planned differently than that. He turned out to be a nice guy. Nice guy. The sweetheart, this guy. He's a Marine Corps. Now, this girl that I was never supposed to see, was never supposed to have anything to do, got on a bus in that last big rainstorm we had in Tustin and transferred five times and rode all day in the rain to come and sit in my dining room so when I came home from work she could say to me, Daddy, how you gonna like being a grandfather? I almost missed that, folks. I'll come that close. But by the grace of God and a miracle called Alcoholics Anonymous, I could have missed the whole thing. Here, I could have come into Alcoholics Anonymous and settled for the crumbs of life instead of sitting at the table and eating the feast. Oh, how good my God has been to me. Right before we come here to have dinner, I call my home and talk to my 16-year-old and my blue-eyed woman. And my 16-year-old told me to tell you our little story, my 16-year-old and mine. And Daddy told me to remind you this, that when Daddy and I got married, Dottie was a career girl, and I'm a guy who spent all of his life locked up in institutions and running streets. We knew nothing about raising kids at all. So we just treat them like drunks. It turned out fine. We just treat them like we treat one of you, and gee, they just doing real well. Not very long. I've always been one of them guys who goes a great deal, and people in Alcoholics Anonymous ask me to come, I'll come, and make a difference to me, I just go. Never take in consideration what day it is, what time it is, what week it is, or whatever it is, I just go. One Sunday, a few years ago, I got up one Sunday morning, I was going to a meeting over in La Habra. I remember it was like a breakfast meeting on a Sunday morning, and I got my coat on, my tie, and I'm going out the door, and my little girl ran into me. She said, "Hey, Dad, where are you going?" Because I'm going to an AA meeting, sweetheart. And she said, "Daddy, it's my birthday." I said, "Oh?" She said, "What's the matter with you? Don't you ever consider anything but yourself? What kind of a nothing are you? All you do is go to them meetings. Don't you ever think about me and whatever I want?" I said, "Gee, I'm sorry, baby." And so she broke down and started crying where Donnie was. And God, I felt guilty about that. And I started to sneak out the door. I was going to go into the meeting anyhow. As I started to get in my car, my little girl showed up at the door. She said, "Just a moment, Daddy." And I ran out there. She threw her arms around me. She got great big old brown eyes. She started crying. She said, "When you get to the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, will you tell them something for me?" I said, "Okay, baby." She said, "Will you thank the people of Alcoholics Anonymous for my daddy?" She said, "If it hadn't been for people like you taking time out of your life to come see people like me, that little girl wouldn't even be here. And if she was here, I wouldn't be here to take care of her. So I thank you for my little girl's daddy. I thank you for every living thing I have. I thank you for the way I feel inside, for the way I'm going to feel inside. I'm going to thank you for the thousands of countless blessings that are going to come my way in the Tomorrowland. I'd like to stand here and thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. But more important than anything that I know of, I'd like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for my God. Thank you."